Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, or good night. Thank you for joining the show. You are now rocking with the best. My name is Kwame, aka Can't Stop, Won't Stop, and welcome to another 1v1 where I go one-on-one with some of my favorite people in the hockey world. My next guest holds the key to the castle, holds down one of the most scrutinized jobs in hockey, but somebody's got to do it. Soul brothers and soul sisters, let me introduce you to the commissioner of the National Hockey League, Gary Bettman. And Gary, as we say in Canada, how's it going, eh?
It's going great. That may be one of the best introductions I've ever heard. So I have to thank you. And it certainly was the most energetic. And Kwame, it's great to be with you.
Thank you so much. You know, it was interesting. Last night, I was just getting myself prepared to talk to you today. And I was thinking about, you know, in the hockey world, everybody has a nickname, but I've never heard one for you. What does everybody call you?
Well,
do you have a nickname?
There's no one size fits all on this.
Okay.
Brian Burke, when he worked at the league office, referred to me as boss.
Okay.
And to this day, he keeps doing that. And okay. It is a term of affection from him. And a number of the people I work with and know Brian have adopted that name. Some people call me Commish. You know, I always prefer to just be called Gary.
Yes, I do. I do. Because, you know, everybody's got like the players, they all have a key or a C at the end of their name. Yes. So I was like, do people call him Betsy? I was like, that.
No, when I was younger, it was Betty.
Well, speaking of younger, you know, first off, I want to congratulate you and your team for executing and completing this year's playoffs. You know, in a world where we can't please everyone, I thought you all did the best you could considering everything that's been thrown at us from the start of 2020. And I'm sure there were a lot of long hours and sleepless nights, but congratulations first and foremost.
Well, thank you. The sleepless nights came not from the planning and implementation, because we had a terrific collaborative effort with the players. We created a tournament that had integrity because it accounted for the fact that our competitive balance is so extraordinary and we couldn't complete the regular season. And we wanted the teams and particularly their fans to believe that every team had a chance fairly, you know, because mm-hmm. the teams that were on the bubble and the players were great, both in terms of what they accomplished and did on the ice, but also the way they bought into the protocols, because being away from family and friends for as mm-hmm. long as 2 months is a lot to ask. Having said that, the sleepless nights came over what we couldn't control.
Yeah.
I mean, and we're seeing it now with COVID-19. And the spiking, and despite your best intentions and all of the things that you work so hard to do, there was always a chance that we were going to have some positive tests and an outbreak. But our theory all along was, and this is where the players were great, we had protocols for working out. We then had protocols for training camp. Mm-hmm. And by the time we got into the bubbles, we had pretty well filtered ourselves.
Right.
And we got into the bubbles without any COVID-19. And once we got in, we thought we'd be able to maintain it. So it was, and a lot of people, obviously, as I said, the players were incredible, but Steve Mayer and his group in events, setting up the bubbles, Coley Campbell and hockey operations doing what they do to make sure the games got played in a competitively fair and safe environment, sensational.
Yeah. Well, again, I appreciate you coming on and talking with me. And I, you know, we're obviously going to get into some of the obvious questions, but I really wanted to start with your parents. What's your earliest memory of them, and what kind of environment did you grow up in?
My memories are a little distant because my dad died when I was 13 of leukemia. And my mom died when I was 40 of brain cancer. And so they haven't been around in my life. And also when I was 4 years old, and this was fairly unusual in the 50s, You know, when you track my age, my parents got divorced.
Okay.
I think I was, if not the only, one of the only kids in my public elementary school in Queens, New York, to be living in a single parent household. That was pretty extraordinary back in the 50s.
Wow. How did that shape you as a young man, having to deal with that, seeing your other friends grow up with the mother and father, and then your father pass away at such a young age?
It makes you determined. Mm. It makes you fiercely independent. It makes you understand that you've got to focus on things through your own eyes, and you have to rely on yourself a lot. At that young age, I then learned through the magic of marriage what it's like to be in a loving partnership. So, you know, it's a mixed bag. Listen, everybody has things in their journey that are less than ideal.
Yeah.
And it's really a question of how you deal with it.
And it makes you stronger, right?
Hopefully.
Yeah, definitely. I spent a lot of time.
What's the old saying? If it doesn't kill you, it makes you stronger.
That's exactly it. I spent a lot of time, high school summers in Queens, 193rd and Linden Boulevard is where my cousins lived. So I love Queens. Yes, I love Queens.
So I was just down Queens Boulevard in the Van Wyck in Forest Hills.
Okay. Right. That's not too far. That's pretty interesting. What was sports like for you growing up? Were you an athlete or a spectator?
I was a marginal athlete because, remember, growing up in New York City, we had playgrounds. we didn't have grass fields.
Right.
And again, being in a single parent household, with your mom, you're not as exposed to sports as much, you know. And when I see how my children grew up with sports, not just because of their mom and me, but where we lived and their accessibility to every kind of sport was a whole different thing. So a lot of sports I picked up later in life. So for example, I did learn how to ski starting when I was 5 years old, and I was a pretty good skier. Golf I picked up in my late 40s, early 50s, and I'm a terrible golfer, but I enjoy the experience. So it's a mixed bag, but I was always active. Right. And I did, when later on in my adolescence and a remarriage and moving to the suburbs, I did actually play high school soccer at the varsity level. So I did play sports. And then when I got to college, you know, I had accessibility, everything. I even played some intramural rec hockey and you know, had fun.
Ice hockey?
Yes.
Okay.
There are some pictures floating around with me on the ice, probably shabbily dressed from an equipment standpoint and bad posture from a skating standpoint.
Right.
But yes, but I was always a big fan. You know, growing up in the New York metropolitan area, you always had your choice of teams in every major sport. And I was a huge fan, particularly of hockey. Mm. And my fandom really got focused on hockey when I went to Cornell, because that was, you know, at Cornell and in the Ivies, really the preeminent sport, even though right. Ed Marinauer was busy setting the all-time collegiate rushing record at Cornell for a couple of the years when I was there. Hockey was really where it was at.
How were you introduced to the game of hockey? Was it young age or a lot older?
No, I think I went to my first game at Madison Square Garden, 10, 12, somewhere in that range.
Okay. So graduated from Cornell University. You went to New York University of Law. What were those years like for you? Would you consider yourself a serious student back then?
I became more serious. My early years as a student, some might characterize as less than perfect. By the time I got to high school, things were dramatically improving. Okay. I was fortunate enough to get into Cornell, where I did well and got into NYU Law, which, you know, was top 10 law school then. And now it's actually, I think, a top five law school. I probably couldn't have gotten in now, but I got in then. And I got married when I was in law school.
Okay.
And I worked my way through law school. The one thing that was always clear to me increasingly as I got older, maybe it was maturity, you have to work hard for the things that you want.
That's true.
And the things that are important. Things don't come easy.
When did you finish law school?
I finished law school in June of 1977.
77 is a very interesting year because, you know, in New York, that's the year that famous blackout.
Oh, yeah. We were, it's funny you should raise that. The blackout happened in the week leading up, maybe the days leading up to the bar exam. It was in July, I think. We lived at the time in an apartment building that was in New Jersey on the water, a town called Edgewater. And I remember studying and looking across the river and all the lights were out.
Wow.
So I'm thinking, and my first reaction as a competitive law student was, well, I guess those people aren't going to be able to study. So I'm going to get a leg up.
Yeah. Well, and you know, it's also interesting, as scary as that moment was, that night actually accelerated the hip hop movement to where it is right now, because a little fun fact for you and the listeners out there, before that blackout, there was a couple of people in like Harlem or the Bronx who had turntables, very expensive back then, you know, so you can't really have that on every corner. Blackout happened. All of the record stores and equipment, music equipment stores got broken into. So all the turntables and mixers and speakers, people were just stealing them. So the next day, or when things got back to normal, everybody had a turntable and everybody was DJing. So you had it in all these different areas. So
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's very interesting about that blackout. Very famous. People can actually look
that
up.
This is all secondhand to you. You were still a notion, at that point in time.
Yes, I was a notion. I'm just being a historian on that. You know, I love the history of music. I love the history of sports. And I think, sports and music play hand in hand.
Well, you know, it's interesting because in the history of sports. So I'm growing up as a youngster between four, my mom remarried when I was 12, 13. But in that intervening period, my introduction to sports was everything that I did. It wasn't being handed from generation to generation.
Right.
So I gravitated to the expansion teams because then I had instant history.
Right.
I was there at the beginning. It was only years after the fact, when I look back at it, that I was able to conclude that instinctively must have been why I did that.
Yeah,
I wasn't conscious at the time.
I mean, it's always great to see something from the beginning and follow it year after year after year. You spent a lot of time in the NBA and the
12
NBA.
Years.
Yeah, 12 years. And the NBA has, really embraced hip hop culture. Do you feel that that type of culture has room in the NHL?
I believe that in all sports, particularly with hockey players, the most important things that our fans want and our players want is authenticity.
Yes.
And so what it's not about, just marketing what you think is the right image or promoting it. It's what feels right to you. And I think our players, have a very eclectic and diverse set of interests. And I want them and our fans to feel comfortable and welcomed no matter who you are, what you believe, and what interests you.
Yeah, because I think guys would say that the locker room environment when it comes to music is a lot different than it was.
Absolutely.
In the past, and a lot of it right
by the
now.
Way, I, when I'm down on the event level, I hear that as well. And that's great, because if that's what the players are feeling, if that's what gets them up, if that's what gets them excited, if that's what gets them emotionally engaged and charged, that's great. Doesn't matter what it is. It's got to be what you feel.
Yeah. And it's just, it just takes the, you know, the people behind the scenes to amplify that, to connect the dots between the players and their vibe and the fans and their vibe, marry those things together. Mm-hmm. And then you get a great product.
And that's where social media has become increasingly important. You know, I think historically people believe that our sport tends to be more team centric and team focused, less individual. And so maybe for a while, a lot of our guys were more hesitant to express themselves on social media.
Right.
But that's changing. That's changing as we skew younger. And it's also changing because we've made it a priority to work with the players and get them comfortable expressing themselves on social platforms.
I think it's something, you know, a huge burden lifted off these players' shoulders now to be able to be in an environment where they can feel like they can express themselves.
Because they understand that it's okay.
Yes.
You know, if you go back 20, 30 years for somebody to be out there as an individual expressing themselves, may not have been as acceptable in the locker room and in the team, among the team itself. But I think players, particularly the younger players who get social media, you know, when you get to be my age, social media is less intuitive,
right?
And the younger you get, the easier it is to do it and relate to it. And I think our players get it. And I think that's great to see, because having a greater connection with fans is one of the things that's evolving in sports, mm-hmm. whether it's, as we're discussing, players and social media and connecting with fans that way, or it's the emphasis now on all access.
Yes.
That when I was a teenager, well, I could only visualize in my mind what a locker room looked like. Mm. Right now you see the players getting dressed for games. You see with their locker rooms, with the all access shows, you see the coaches making speeches. You're connecting with the game as a fan on a whole host of levels that were always there, but you were never privileged to see.
How do you stay on top of that? You know, I was a radio announcer for 14 years, and I always felt that the demise of certain radio stations was the bosses were never in touch with what the people or the trends were. How do you personally stay on top of what is going on?
You have to be open-minded.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be connected yourself. You have to look at your children and your grandchildren, not through the prism of why is that different than when I was that age, but what are the things that are important to them and their friends.
Mm-hmm.
It's you know, you can't isolate yourself in a bubble. What you've got to do is make sure that you have a broad world view of things and be as open-minded as possible. And at least me personally, but on a professional level, is surround yourself with extraordinarily talented, well-informed people mm-hmm. who can make me smarter than I am.
So when you spent your time in the NBA, you were a senior VP of general counsel. What does that
mean? I was senior vice president and general counsel.
Okay.
That made me, you know, in the top three. It was David Stern, Russ Granick, and me.
Mm-hmm.
I was responsible for our legal issues and also the marketing and promotion and licensing was reporting to me as well. So I had a pretty broad portfolio, which put me in good stead when I came to the NHL in 93.
How did you take, or do you take those experiences and bring them along with you to the NHL?
Nothing in our world, in our industry in particular, is on a cookie cutter basis. You know, you learned that there are essential organizational priorities that you have to address. But just because the NBA or the NFL or Major League Baseball does something doesn't mean that it's right for us, because it goes back to what you and I were discussing a few minutes ago. You got to be authentic.
Yep.
You got to focus on what's the important elements and the most interesting, entertaining, exciting, important parts of our game and what it represents, and you have to accentuate those. It's really, you don't tailor the game to market it or to use technology. You use marketing and promotion and technology to accentuate the strongest elements of your game and to the connectivity that you give your fans to the game.
That's interesting. So you go from the NBA to the NHL. What was your first approach at being the commissioner? Because if I'm correct, there was just a president before you. You're like the first commissioner?
Well, the organization, yes, I was the first commissioner. That was part of my effort to modernize our operations. There was a sense that maybe the NHL could have evolved a little faster than it did prior to my getting there. And I thought it would be important symbolically to make a statement that we were modernizing like the other three major leagues, and that I had to build an organization that had the expertise, the agility, and the energy to do the things that needed to get done to build and grow the game and to make sure that our fans were feeling well served and connected.
So did the NHL come to you, or did you go to the NHL? And in that process, who was more nervous, you or your wife?
My wife, not nervous at all, completely supportive.
She's the rock.
No, what happened was the NHL in late 92 did a search, and they wanted to identify somebody who could lead the league forward and do some of the things that weren't being done, and to grow the game, both in terms of attendance and fan base and television, to stabilize collective bargaining, to do all the things that you needed to do to have an agenda to move the game and the business of the game forward. And they did a search, having always been a hockey fan, and as we've discussed, an intense one, particularly since my days at Cornell. Mm-hmm. I was interested, and I was the one, when they were done searching, they had used the search firm, and they kept narrowing the candidates down. And I think there was a final bake-off of five or six finalists. And when they were done with that process, they offered me the position.
Do you remember any of those people you were up against?
No, I don't. That was 28 years ago.
I wonder if they're still.
And again, it wasn't like we were in the same room at the same time.
Right.
I mean, they were just names out there.
I wonder if they're still salty that they didn't get the job.
I don't know.
So you mentioned that your wife is the person that's never nervous. She wasn't nervous. She seems like the rock. Because I remember when you were inducted into the Hall of Fame, you talked very highly of her.
Highly isn't strong enough.
Not strong enough.
We'll use lovingly.
Okay. So when it comes to you as commissioner, how much do you lean on her with the day-to-day struggles or issues? Is she your sounding board?
Well, she was a psychotherapist.
Okay.
So she's very good at keeping me and our family balanced. And she really had a full-time job. So when I say she retired, it was retiring from being a psychotherapist. Mm. But in terms of our family, particularly with the demands on me and my lack of availability at times, she did a great job as a mom and does a great job as a mom, although our children now range in age basically from 32 to 42. Uh-huh. And we have five grandchildren, ranging in age from just almost 3 to 14. And as we're speaking, at some point in the next few days, we should have the sixth grandchild.
Oh, good for you. Congratulations.
So she has more than a full-time job keeping track of everybody, including and especially me, and she keeps me well grounded.
That's great to hear. There's a book, it's called The Four Agreements. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it. It's like a great self-help book, and one of the principles is not to take things personal. How hard is it for you to do that and not, to do what you do and not take things personal?
It goes back to the discussion when you asked me what it was like growing up.
Yeah.
Right. In a single parent household, my my guiding principle is whatever you're doing, you do your best, you work your hardest, you learn as much as you can, and then whatever decision you make, you do what you think is right. Mm-hmm. And yes, particularly in this job, there will always be critics.
Yep.
And I respect that and I understand it. Frequently, the critics don't know quite as much about what you did and why you did it as you do. Mm-hmm. And the fact of the matter is, this isn't a popularity contest. This is me trying to steer our game and our industry in the directions that I think are important and right to continue to grow the game, to make sure we're relevant and exciting. And not everybody's going to agree with you. Yeah. And that's okay.
It's interesting. Some of those things you just said were principles of the Four Agreements. And it just seems like you live your life with having those in them.
But I didn't read the book.
Right. Instinctively, which is really interesting to me. And speaking of books, Dylan DeMello from the Winnipeg Jets, he's a big reader in his spare time. You know, how important is spare time for you, free time for you? Because I honestly, I can see you being a guy that has a man cave and you're in there playing Call of Duty online, video game
wrong.
Style. No, wrong?
Okay. No Call of Duty. I wouldn't call it a man cave, but I have in addition to my office in the house, I have a room that has three television screens.
Okay.
So I can watch multiple games at once. So okay. Instead of playing video games, I'm watching our games. Free time is at a premium. Family time is the most important use of what free time there is. Anticipating your next possible question, my reading consists a lot of historical biographies.
Okay.
I like to see how people fit in the context of their time, the challenges that they had, the decisions that they made, and how they addressed them. Whether it's Churchill or Hamilton or, you know, the list or any of the founding fathers or whether it's business people, you know, getting their perspective on what the times were and how they dealt with them is important. Doesn't mean they were all right or wrong. Doesn't mean they were all angels. What it means is you can get an insight as to how they functioned.
I believe, and with that, do you stick with the usual suspects of books or are you willing to try to go outside of it? And I think about that because you say you love, you know, to think about a person in their times, and this is totally outside the box, but the RZA from the Wu-Tang Clan, I'm a big fan of the Wu-Tang Clan and hip hop. He's got a book, I think it's called The Art of the Wu. And I think it, as an autobiography, that's a really good book to read about what he was going through. Are you that kind of person?
I'm open to anything. So send me the coordinates.
I'm going to.
And I'll take a look at it. And awesome. It's the same thing. I like watching documentaries.
Great, great. There's a pretty good one out there called Soul on Ice, Past, Present, and Future.
Yeah, I'm aware.
So let's look at 2020 so far. Worldwide pandemic, social justice unrest that's affected the sports world, major presidential election that everyone's been following. What are your thoughts on this year so far and as it comes to an end?
It's been a challenging year.
Yeah.
And some of the challenges have been more difficult than others.
Mm-hmm.
But whether it's social justice, where there's been more attention, more of an awakening, I think that's a good thing. Pandemic, not so good.
No.
No matter, you know, how you deal with health and safety, and maybe in terms of the medical community who deserves every accolade imaginable, whether it's how they've managed, how they've given them themselves, or even how quickly they've been able to create a vaccine. I mean, out of difficult times, sometimes comes positives. From a business standpoint, I look at it that we just needed to focus on what our options were, what needed to be done, and to be agile enough to address what needed to be done, because I thought it was important to the players and our fans that we complete the 19-20 season. And I think mm-hmm. we did it first and foremost with health and safety in mind, but also with integrity.
Yes.
And so It's about managing, it's about evolving, and it's about moving forward, even though this was especially because this was an extraordinarily difficult and challenging year.
Right. When I was telling some of my friends that I'd be speaking to you, they were like, ask him about being booed. Ask them about being booed. And I wasn't going to, but I thought.
Who gets booed? it was interesting because as people saw when I presented the Stanley Cup, which we did a little bit differently to the Tampa Bay Lightning this year,
yes,
by bringing up the whole team, because I thought under the circumstances, this was the consummate team effort.
Yeah.
It was easier to talk about the importance of presenting the cup when it wasn't as noisy. but listen, it's become a thing. Not just me. It's all commissioners.
Yeah.
And I don't take it personally. The line I use a lot, and it's not far from the truth. If everybody who came up to me after I presented the cup and said, this was wonderful, but I don't understand why all those people booed you, I didn't. If everybody who told me that was telling the truth, there wouldn't have been any booing.
Right. But you know what I thought was interesting when people were saying that to me and I thought about asking you that? I think you would take those boos any time of the day just to have those fans back in the arena.
Oh, absolutely. To watch the game. Actually, I said that when we were talking. We missed having our fans in the building. We missed them terribly. Our fans it's not about the money. Mm. Okay. What it's about is our players and our game get an incredible energy from our fans.
The experience.
The environment in our buildings, which are basically sold out all season and the playoffs, is incredible. There's nothing like it in sports. Mm. The emotion, the edginess, the energy, the community of people coming together in support of their team, watching the world's best athletes play the world's best sport. That's an essential ingredient of our game, and we missed it. Nothing we could do about it, obviously, other than play the games for television, but that is essential to our games, and we can't wait to have our fans back.
I was just watching like a TSN top 10 list, and I just kept gravitating to the crowd, and I kept thinking to myself, oh my God, have we been taking our social interaction for granted all these years? And did the universe just say, I'm going to take that away for you so you can, appreciate it even more?
That was one of the challenges of 2020.
Yeah.
Right? But you know what? When things are going right and you're focused on the next task or the next event or what you're doing or going to a game with your friends, you don't think about the broader view of like, gee, what if this all went away?
Yeah.
And sometimes when things go away or when challenges are presented, it makes you more focused and more appreciative of what it means.
Like I said this at the beginning, you can't please everyone. And I think that as long as your intentions are in the right place, you could probably sleep well at night. How do you humble yourself to make sure that whatever decision you make, agree or disagree from the audience and the world, how do you humble yourself to feel that what it is that you're doing is morally right and you're good with it?
Well, and we discussed this briefly before, when I have to make a decision or I have to set a priority, which is making a decision, do all the homework on whatever the issue is. Satisfy yourself that you know everything that you could possibly know. And then you make a decision for the right reasons. You don't do it for political reasons. You don't do it for expedient reasons. You do what you do because you think it's the right thing to do.
Right.
And if you do that, listen, is everybody right 100% of the time? No. But at least you know you tried your best and you made the decision for the right reasons. Mm-hmm. You get in the Baseball Hall of Fame if you're right 3 out of 10 times. The fact of the matter is, you got to do better than that doing what I do for a living and having the privilege to do it. But you got to do your best, take your best shot. And if you think you made a decision that was well-informed and for the right reasons, you can sleep at night because, again, there may be things that intervene that you didn't know about. You just deal with it.
And again, for a person who hasn't read the Four Agreements, you hit one of the principles, always try your best. So again, very interesting that it's just
that's a life lesson no matter what you're doing.
Yeah, exactly. Let's talk about the game's growth in the minority communities. How important is growing the game in these communities to hockey and more specifically to the NHL?
Well, it's vitally important. And I don't think we get enough credit, and you know as well as anybody, for the efforts we've made over the last couple of decades. And whatever we've done isn't enough, and we need to do more, and we're very focused on that. But I believe that creating a welcoming environment so that anybody can, particularly young people, can be a part of this great game, and again, for young people, to use the game to learn life's lessons is the two-way street. It's our way of giving back, because whether it's teamwork or leadership or physical fitness or getting an education or being diligent and focused, those are the values of our game. And we want to make sure that anybody can feel comfortable either playing our game at any level or being a fan of the game. And that diversity is and inclusiveness is a strength. And that's something we are absolutely committed to. Now, different people will have varying views as to what the best way to do that is. Mm-hmm. And we're trying very hard to do the right things, to improve on what we've done. Kim Davis, who you know, works with us, and I'm fortunate that she's come to the league to work with us. Now it's been 3 years. And not only is she giving us a vision, but she's educating our organization on the ways that we can be better than we've ever been. And so I'm very optimistic about the future of being diverse and inclusive and creating a welcoming environment. But it is a work in progress, but it's a work that we're committed to.
As a white male, are you using this time to educate yourself even more about
the Absolutely. Issues? Yeah? Remember before we talked about having a broader worldview?
Yes.
Is notwithstanding all of my experiences, all of the things that I was taught growing up or I learned in college, I learned a lot this year about what I didn't know and I needed to know, and I'm still learning.
Awesome. You know, I wanted to ask you if the industry of hockey is ready for culture change, but then I thought to myself, the change is already happening. So I guess my question is, how is the industry adjusting to the change from your viewpoint?
Well, I don't think it's an adjustment. I think it's an evolution.
Okay.
And like other elements of the game we talked about, whether it's music or social media, it needs to be authentic. Mm-hmm. And the players have to be an integral part of it. They set the example, they're role models, but also how the game lives and breathes is going to be a function of the way the players actually live it and breathe it. And so, yeah, they're going through an evolution with us as well. It's about education, it's about training, it's creating programs. You know, Kim has created the Executive Inclusion Council to set goals and objectives for us and to hold ourselves accountable. We have a Player Inclusion Council. We have a Fan Inclusion Council. We're reaching out to every conceivable constituent group to make sure that we're learning and doing the things that everybody thinks are important to continue that evolution and growth.
Were you shocked when you were called for the Hall of Fame?
Shocked? Not, you know, based on my life and what I do day to day, few things shock me. I was surprised. More so, I suppose, at the timing of it. I thought that was for older people when they retired. So I didn't know if this was a message that they were putting me out the pasture. But, you know, the most important thing, my immediate reaction was, this is great for my family, for my wife and my kids and my grandkids, because they have lived this journey with me. at many, many important points, understanding that I wasn't quite as available to them if I had a normal job.
Right.
And the fact that, that this was a recognition for all of them, as much if not more than me, that this was a recognition of the organization, both at the league level and the teams level, that this was a recognition of the support that I had gotten for ownership, and that this was a recognition of our game. That was what was important to me.
I found it interesting because, you know, Gary Bettman knows what's going on in the NHL. How did they even keep that from you? You know,
well, we don't control the Hall of Fame.
Okay.
Right. It's an independent. One of the things I did early on in my tenure was create a greater independence of the Hall of Fame. So there was no way for me to know. It's not like it's not the NHL Hall of Fame.
Right.
It's the Hockey Hall of Fame, which includes obviously significant.
But you know all those guys who make those decisions.
Despite my age, I thought I was too young.
Okay. Out of that class, who were you most proud to stand beside?
You know what? All of them.
Yeah.
It's a great class because everybody who got in with me deserved to get in. And, you know, it was a great class. And you know, for the players, these were players I got to watch play.
It was great to see Willie.
Particularly during my tenure.
Yeah, it was great to see Willie get in there at the same time as you.
Well, I mean, listen, Willie, you know, and I have had a long-term relationship. And so when you asked me the question, I gave you the political answer because I never like to pick one over the other. But being able to go in with Willie was an incredible honor.
Yeah.
He's a remarkable man. He's a good friend. And his energy, his commitment to the game, his love of working with children has been phenomenal. And frankly, I consider us fortunate that we found him and gave him a place in our game again later in life.
I got two more questions for you. One, you've been around some very important people in your tenure from the NBA to the NHL. What would you say is your pinch me moment from the person that you met? Who did you meet that you were like, oh,
this is like the Hall of Fame question. I never like to do it. I've been lucky. I've met presidents and governors and prime ministers and premiers. I actually had a session with President Putin after the Olympics in Sochi.
Okay.
But again, all of those meetings aren't about me.
Right.
They're about a connection to the game that I have the privilege of representing.
Right, right. You know, during interviews like this, you hear when you ask a person, like, when you leave the game, how do you want people to remember you? I don't feel like you're the kind of person who worries about that sort of thing. So I'm going to phrase it a little bit like this. When you leave the game, what does Gary Bettman want to say about Gary Bettman and what he has done in his time in the league?
He worked hard. Mm. He did his best. Then he made a difference, not just in the game, but in the lives of people who the game touched.
Usually in our show, I have a young man by the name of Akil Thomas, who was drafted to the LA Kings with me, and Elijah Roberts. And we have a lot of fun with our guests. We do a thing called our top five. Usually on our one-on-ones, I don't do it. But with you, because we talked about music, I want to get top five songs Gary Bettman may listen to on his way to the office or to a game, wherever it is. Give me five songs.
I'm classic vinyl all the way.
Give it to me.
Okay. So anything by Neil Young or Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young.
Okay.
Anything by The Doors. I am stuck in the 60s and early 70s. And so
a little Hendrix in there, a little Hendrix.
I saw Hendrix in concert before
wow.
he passed away. Absolutely Hendrix. I mean, it is the Stones from
yes.
vintage era in the 60s. So you put my head back in the late 60s, early 70s.
And we got
that's transformational for me. in terms of what I'm thinking.
I named my son after Jimi Hendrix. His first name is Hendrix.
Wow. That's very cool.
That's how much I love him. Gary, I've got to say this to you, man. And I think I've told you this before, how much I appreciate you and what you've done for me and my family. You know, I was at a time in my life where things weren't, you know, I didn't know what was going to happen. And I made this little movie because I had such a passion for the game of hockey. I had such a passion for Black history and how those two meshed. And when I was done that film, and I had a really good showing in Edmonton, again, I didn't know what we were going to do in the future. And then lo and behold, someone said, Gary Bettman wants to see the film. You watch the film. And all of a sudden, the NHL took over. We showed it in Washington, D.C. And 5 years later, I am here right now talking to you one-on-one on a podcast that's in the NHL platform. And I have done work with Kim Davis. I have done work with so many people in the NHL. I've done some great creative stuff. And I just want to say to you that if you didn't have to do that, and I just want you to know how much I personally appreciate that.
You know, life is a journey. And it's about the people you meet along the way. Mm-hmm. And I'm just thrilled that you've been a part of that journey.
Thank you. And with that being said, my soul brothers and soul sisters, the one and only Gary Bettman, the commissioner of the National Hockey League, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. Stay safe and be well.